Accession number 22658, Route 15.
This is the eighth reel of a taped interview with Norden Digby in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 28th of the 11th, 2001, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Norden, we'll be talking about, I presume, the morale of the troops at this particular point. You mentioned the ho-hoing and the jeering and that sort of thing. How high would you rate the morale?
Well, I think it was reasonably normal. There was no despondency or anything of that nature. Talking about the ho-ho situations, at night time you'd hear one of the battalions or units away in the background, and it had come into the next one, and come into the next one, and next one, and next one, one after the other. So it took, I don't know what the locals, but I mean, they were farming people, so it wasn't densely populated, but I often wondered what they thought about what the hell was going on. And it got so bad in the end that I think there was a general orders come out, it was to stop. But it really didn't. But nevertheless, they were all in pretty high spirits. And, it was time to go again, sort of business. And
was there this sort of feeling that, oh, we've done enough?
Oh, well, if
had it, enough.
There might have only be a few that'd be that way, and if it got them pretty bad, they'd disappear. AWL or something like that, but there wasn't much of that going on, plus the fact that you had new reinforcements coming in all the time, sort of business, to make up for the aged and the injured and things of that nature. Though most of the injury business would have been sorted out before we got to the Atherton Tablelands and those sorts of areas. And of course some were because of their previous experience in, let's say, farming or specialised, they removed from the army and went back to their normal work life. Particularly with farmers, quite a lot of farmers, and sons of farmers were taken out. But it'd have to be a pretty good story to get out. Bearing in mind experienced soldiers, they didn't want to lose those sort of fellows. So, but there used to be a lot of cock and bull yarns come up, but that was a good bit of humour when. Some of the stories they used to put up at the rate. But generally speaking, it was time to move, and bearing in mind the actions of the Japanese, which were pretty, let's say, gruesome, if that's the word. I'm not referring to what they did to prisoners of war, but I mean the general thought of them taking over. Or landing in Australia, and if they moved as fast as they did in the Asian countries and things like that, it wouldn't have been long before they could have got right down into the major areas, or Sydney and Melbourne areas, or the outskirts of New South Wales and Victoria.
You were to leave in July of 44. To what extent were they seriously seen as a threat to Australia at this point, do you think?
Well, there was the stopping them on a trail, and both through nine Divi troops and militia troops and things of that nature. And that, I think, you know, that was sort of a stopping situation which allowed us a bit more breathing space and building up, and of course, what with the aid of American equipment and supplies and things of that nature. And of course, then again, there was they had terrific lines of communication to contend with, and the American air force and that, plus the Navy, were basically in superior numbers and things like that. So, you know, if there's any supplies coming down, plus the fact of information being passed from coastal watch people and the like, they'd be onto it before long, and you know, strafing and bombing shipping and things like that. So they were at a disadvantage, more so than ours. And that was just my general thoughts on
that. To what degree did you sort of see your position at this particular point as a secondary one, possibly to whatever the Americans were doing?
Yes, yeah, that'd be fairly true. I mean, they were, what with MacArthur being the commander in chief, let's say, of the military forces, well, of the whole situation. So, and bearing in mind our numbers compared to American forces that were there, were, you know, just basically in the minority, numerically anyway. But you know, I think the general opinion, though there might be a bit of bias in it, was the Australian troops had put the stopping apart in New Guinea. And that was always up our sleeve, and we just sort of, you know, so we, the whole of our forces, and that were able to, you know, just carry on as usual, as long as we had the backups and things. But sometimes there'd be situations where you didn't get the support from the Navy or the Air Force or something like that, but that did occur on a number of occasions. But I think that there's always that problem, the rivalry between the complete defence forces and things. But apart from those, we just take a soldier on, and quite frequently you're told to do things that you knew weren't going to be end up with the right result. There's nothing you do about it. But so, generally speaking, like that. But getting back to our particular situation, when we arrived at Moresby, as I said, we're out on the coastal areas, not far away from the Jackson aerodrome, which was extensively used by the American bombers and that for all their attacks in various places amongst all the islands. Because there wasn't any tank action in the Markham Valley area, there was a necessity for us to be there for not only for tanks and for bunker work, it was decided that our services weren't wanted, so we remained in the Moresby area. We still carried on with our training, with the, not so much the guns, but the 4.2 mortars and general infantry training, because we knew that we were liable to be called upon if it was necessary. And then again, to keep us physically fit and things of that nature, there was a lot of sport played. I think the regiment ended up being, the battery of the regiment ended up being the ultimate winners of whatever contest was in the area. We got pushed from pillar to post in regards to command. That on one occasion, virtually the whole of the battery was involved in digging coastal gun pits along along the coastline, I'm talking about real coastal guns, that are in the 105mm or 150mm, and there was no bulldozers or anything like that. It was wheelbarrow jobs and that type of thing. That kept a fair of them out of any trouble. There was no such thing as leave or anything. There was no place to go to anywhere. We did get a ration of beer whenever it was available. Some of us even ran a still and things of that nature, but not to upset anybody. whilst I was in this Pompob Park, was the name of the camp area that we were in, and playing football, I was double tackled and I ended up in hospital with this dislocated shoulder, so I was out of action for 3 weeks in hospital in light duties, and then I was whipped off to an instructional school for a while. But those were the sorts of things that were happening as far as the 10 battery of the 3rd Anti Tank Regiment. No, 11 battery was attached to 9 different, and they were involved in numerous and various types of actions in Leith and Charve and Saddleburg area and things like that. But I'm not sure, we were there for about 5 to 6 months, we were directed to come back to Australia from there, and we came back on the Carina and went off on 24 days leave back to the west.
How did you found your experience of Moresby and the surrounding area as opposed to the desert, for instance?
Well, Moresby wasn't that bad because it was sparsely wooded, and there was all low, it was coastal strip, and there were open spaces and things, but the main things that we had to concentrate on was tropical diseases and things of that nature. And of course, hygiene was another thing that was, well, as far as our units were concerned, they were pretty strict about things like that. Sometimes when you moved into somebody else's camp, you wondered who in the hell was in charge of them. But We'd never had any sort of bad outbreaks of dysentery or types of those sorts of things, but you only had to reduce your standards of hygiene and you'd be in trouble. But the other thing was we used to illegally fish with grenades and all those sorts of things. But, so we'd, you know, supplement the camp with fresh fish, sort of bit. But the point was you had to do it pretty quick, cook it pretty quickly because of tropical areas and the explosive force upsets their gut system, things like that. But the locals start to do it afterwards, so I think they still do it. Yeah.
How did the locals interact with you?
We didn't have any problems at all with them, not at all.
There'd been this sort of close bond, I understand, from the Kokoda track.
They were always respected, they were always treated reasonably well. I mean, none of this coon stuff or anything like that. Not, you know, like the way the Americans treated their coloured troops and things like that, which, I mean, later on that was all that stopped, but I mean, there was no bigger pardons when, you know, if you want to go and talk to a Negro or something like that, or hold a conversation with him or appear friendly, exceptionally friendly with him or something like that, and they were the Americans, the white Americans, didn't appreciate that sort of situation. And, well, they're not the only. I mean, we had the same trouble in Syria because we fraternised with the Africans, you had to be a bit sensible about it. You knew it wasn't what was wanted, but that was the situation. But while we were in that Moresby situation, they were flying troops across the Iron Stanley, and there was a complete company of infantry at the end of this Jackson Drome, and they were fully armed to go aboard and go land and ready for action. So you can imagine carrying grenades and all those things. A flying fortress from off the Jackson Drome failed to get off the ground and lobbed in amongst them with a full load of bombs, and there was a terrible situation happened there, and we were nearly taken to replace them. And apparently they overcame it somehow or other. But that was you can just imagine what would happen there. 150 blokes or something like that. A lot of them were burnt, and there were naturally deaths and things. And the hospital was chock-a-block with injuries and things like that. So that was probably one of the serious situations that occurred whilst we were there. But there were air raids at times and things like that, but we were well away from them. There'd be air raids on the port mainly because of shipping and things of that nature. But as far as visiting Port Moresby, I think it wasn't on sort of business.
So there was still quite a bit of evidence of Japanese presence.
Yes, it'd be mainly Air Force. Might have been a few subs around or something like that. But that's basically the situation we were placed in.
I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the aerodrome that you were based near the Jackson Aerodrome, and what the atmosphere was like, how often the bombers would be coming in and taking off.
We're pretty close to, continuous, not 24 hours a day situation, but every day or every other day. Of course, then again, it depends upon the weather, because they had to get over the Iron Stanleys, which were treacherous outfits, and might have been all right for the even powerful aircraft, but DC-3s and things like that. And another thing, we had to train in loading our 6-pounder guns into the DC-3s, which fortunately it had to be cancelled in the end because we weren't wanted, but it was absolutely dangerous as far as trying to manhandle things up ramps and as I mentioned previously, there's no balanced parts about them, and they only need one fellow to slip or something like that, and there'd be some trouble. So, nor would we appreciate it flying over the Iron Stanleys with those on board. But I would say that.
You head off in July of 44. Had you heard of, for instance, the landings, the D-Day landings in June? About a month earlier?
We had the availability of radio and things like that, so we were well informed on that's in the camping areas, well informed on what's happening.
But, what else were you able to hear about how the war was going in Europe up until the time you left New Guinea?
Realised the intensity of crossing the channel and things of that nature, and also the reports of the fortifications by the Germans on the beaches and things like that. So it was pretty horrific to think of what they had to go through. And apart from that, we saw all the other infrastructure that was being brought into the Normandy beach areas and things like that, and they were, like sitting ducks the Germans and their troops were experienced gunners and things of that nature. And obviously their officers and that, and APIC work and things like that, plus the fact that they knew all the ranges on the surrounding beach areas and things like that.
Hearing news of the liberation of Paris and that sort of thing, how did it make you feel about you still being
in? Well, we weren't too friendly with the French generally, I suppose it was a hand-me-down from our forefathers, so we didn't seem to pay too much attention to it. With de Gaulle and that, I suppose had to show a bit of appreciation for what he had sort of held the morale a bit as far as troops and things are concerned. I mean, the Vichy French and the Free French and things of that nature. But he was there, and I suppose with his other loyal generals and that, were able to, sort of have a reasonable amount of command around the place, because he'd be about the only one that could at the time. But of course, then there was so many of the French that were basically on the German side at the time. Whether it was to save their lives or not, it's another matter, but they were there. So, personally, it didn't worry me too much. It was well and truly out of our area, and we had to look after ourselves. Because that was basically the end, as far as they were concerned. They just had to rehabilitate themselves. So
you were heading back to Australia about 6 months after having gone off to New Guinea. So early 45.
Yep, and after our leave, we...
what did you do on your leave? Do you recall?
Just the usual. meeting up with some of the old pals and things, and a few grogs, organising parties, and do the right thing by the family, and try not to annoy the MPs and things, because actually they were pretty strict. Because Gordon Bennett was the big wheel in WA around about that time, and if you walked down St George's Terrace with a slouch hat on when it wasn't turned up, you'd get picked up a quick start. That's how ridiculous it was, because I got pulled up, so that's how I know.
Tell us about that.
Well, I was with a couple of my friends, they were officers, and I had just my slouch down, and we walked down the terrace, and I don't know, probably a couple of MPs pulled us up, or pulled me up, and then I think they must have realised that there were two officers with me, and what could they do about that, because the officers should have pulled me up. Well, that was just sort of slipped over, but just to indicate to you what the discipline that was required. And of course, then if you wore civvies and you got picked up, you'd be in a bit of strife. So
on leave, you're expected to be in uniform
all the time. Yeah, all the time. And but they were fairly strict, and of course the Americans were. Not that the Americans would do anything to you unless you got yourselves involved with them, but shore patrols and things that looked after them, the American side of things, and they from what I can understand, the Navy, you weren't a naval policeman, you were selected to be on those particular patrols, and you might be required to pull somebody into the line that was your best friend or something like that. But the point was that they did it. And so there was a fair bit of discipline around the place at the time.
Well, how was the general feeling in Perth around about that time? This is early 1945. Things are looking pretty positive towards the Europe section, sector anyway.
I think they were 44 might have been a bit different, because there was talk of bombings and ship sightings and vessels coming down the west coast and things like of that nature, and there were stories that we used to hear about them. We could only accept it whether it was a furphy or not. But in 45, I think it was, they were turning back, and we were in a safer situation. I mean, civilianly, we were in a safer situation in 45 than we were in 44. I mean, Europe was in a better situation and had virtually control.
As I understand, you would have been sent back to Borneo, and it would have been the 9th of April on the move to Townsville, as far as I understand.
Yeah.
And so we're heading off to Borneo from there. And this is drawing very close to the end of
that was the war, for in Europe anyway.
Well, in that situation, after we'd returned to our camps in the Afford and Tablelands, we didn't go back to the same one that we were in previously. In fact, we moved several times around, like, from memory. And once again, it was the improvement of upgrading our jungle training, plus the fact that it was whatever we were going to do in the island, because the plan, I just forget what the technical name of the plan was. It was all staged we'd jump from one place to another. The first one would be stage one, stage two, stage three, and six or something like that. And